Well, I'm very pleased and honoured to welcome Professor Parimal Patil, who's from Professor of Indian Philosophy at Harvard University. He's rushed off his feet at the moment at Harvard, and he's very kindly agreed to be here for 2 weeks. He's our Shiv Dasani Fellow, and he's very kindly come for just a shorter period of time. He's an expert in Indian philosophy and Nyaya in Buddhism and various other philosophy of grammar. And he wrote a book against a Hindu god. And he's working on various projects on the interface of Buddhism and Hindu philosophies. Today he's going to address us how to debate with a Buddhist. Apart from punching him on the nose, how to rationally debate with a Buddhist. So,
thank you. So on Monday's lecture, we talked about two of the last Buddhist philosophers working in India and their text tradition, so the Buddhist epistemological text tradition. We talked a little bit about why Buddhist argued. That means, what did Buddhist philosophers think they were doing or hope to accomplish in arguing with non-Buddhist opponents? So that was kind of the big picture, trying to set a broad story about the value of philosophical work for Buddhist philosophers and the value of very technical philosophical work for Buddhist philosophers. So today, in one of his email messages to me, Professor Flood said that I should be technical. And so today, it's going to be a little bit more technical. And if it doesn't go well, he's right here. So today, what we're going to do is we're going to actually pretend that we are at Vikramashila in, let's say, roughly the 11th century. And we're going to try, as best we can, to put ourselves in the shoes of Buddhist and Nyaya philosophers who are debating the existence of Ishvara. So our goal is to follow along with follow along with some of the main currents in this debate, and to try to imagine, I want everyone to imagine or think about what side they're on. Not what side you're on before you look at the arguments, but what side you're on after you consider the arguments. So just on the basis of these very few slivers of an argument, what kinds of intuitions do you have about who wins the day? So it's going to be a collaborative exercise. I'm not going to read. I'm going to try to talk through the argument. I'm going to try to motivate some of the big philosophical moves that are made, and I hope we can all participate. So what that means is, if something doesn't make sense, you have to say, that doesn't make sense. Explain it. And I'll try to explain it. Or maybe someone else can explain it. All right. So that's the first kind of general mode of what we're going to be doing. The second thing is we're going to try to think in the language and idiom of classical Indian philosophers. So we're going to think in their epistemological framework and with their technical terms. And we'll see where that gets us, all right? So that's the task. The nice thing about this task is that we can stop at any point, in a sense. So if we want to talk about something in greater detail, we can choose to go on. So roughly, I'm just going to talk off this handout, and there's some more copies being made. It'll be hard to, it'll be easier to follow with the handout. So I'll talk a little bit in the beginning until the handouts arrive. How about that? So one important thing to ask about Indian philosophical texts, or any Sanskrit text for that matter, is why it exists. It didn't have to be written. It certainly didn't have to be preserved. So why do we have it? And why do we have it in the form that we do? We can ask that in general about a specific text. We can also ask it about genres. And we can also ask it about something as vague as arguments, and particularly Buddhist and Brahminical debates and arguments. So the first question is, why are there actually Buddhist and Brahminical debates and not just arguments? Or maybe you think there are just arguments. And I'll tell you what I think the difference is. And if there are arguments, are they merely polemical? Or are you actually meant to learn from the arguments? Right. So why are there debates? Let's assume there are debates. And what a debate is versus an argument is it's not just one-sided. Right? So there's a given, not a give and take necessarily, but there is at least rhetorically an opponent with whom you argue and who writes back. We know historically that, you know, if a Nyaya philosopher writes a proof, an argument, and a Buddhist responds, it's often critiqued, counter-critiqued, etc., etc. So, why are there these debates? We saw last time why Buddhist philosophers, at least why Buddhist philosophers, how they could rationalize that these debates took place, right? It was part of they had a broader soteriological story to tell. With the Nyaya philosophers, we could do something similar. We're not going to do that today, but that's something else we should do, is why are there debates? Another thing we can ask is, what's necessary for there to be such debates? Remember, these debates didn't just happen on some Wednesday, you know, in the 11th century. They happened over the course of at least 1,300 years. 1,300 years. People spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, writing very technical texts and debating each other. What is necessary for that to happen? What is necessary to sustain, say, 1,300-year debate tradition? Well, let's think about it. What do we need to have a meaningful debate with people for, let's not say 1,300 years, let's just say a year? What's necessary? Well, I don't know about you, but I have to understand the other person. I have to think there's some common basis for agreement and disagreement. Otherwise, you're just yelling at each other, right? And there have to be some set of rules to make you think it's productive, right? That's exactly what was necessary in classical India, too. There had to be some sort of shared conceptual vocabulary. Some vocabulary that would provide at least a lexical or nominal and also conceptual basis for there to be genuine agreement and disagreement, or at least the appearance of genuine agreement and disagreement. And that epistemology we mentioned last time also came really with Dignaga, a Buddhist philosopher in roughly the 5th century. And it's with Dignaga's vocabulary and conceptual framework that interreligious debates and interreligious polemics really took off. And so in a way, we're at the end of this Buddhist philosophical tradition. It began, let's say, with Dignaga, and you can argue it maybe began a little bit before, but I think not. These are the last two Buddhist philosophers writing in India whose work was taken up by non-Buddhist opponents, Rendrakirti and Ñānaśrīmitra. So we got these debates. Why do they exist? Well, we know what the Buddhists say. We don't know what the Brahmins say. What Nyayikas say doesn't really matter. What's needed for such debates? Some kind of basis, shared basis for epistemology, some shared basis for conversation. That basis was really provided by Dignaga, in a sense, and then developed over time. And so what we're going to do is we have to think ourselves into that shared vocabulary. And that's the first real step. What this also suggests is that, look, this kind of inferential reasoning was absolutely crucial, because it provided the main way in which you could actually argue with people who fundamentally disagreed with you. So, for example, if you're arguing with someone who is in fundamental agreement with you, just imagine with a friend who fundamentally agrees with you on most things, what do those arguments look like? What form do they take? How much give and take is there? Versus arguments with people who fundamentally disagree with you, right? It's a very different character. And so this vocabulary was crucial for that. And that kind of debate was crucial and a driving force in at least the history of philosophy in India, and maybe Indian intellectual history, depending on how you understand what intellectual history means. And certainly it was a driving force in what we could call philosophical theology, at least until the 14th or 15th century. And after that, it's a different question, right? So task one is to learn to think this way. And we're going to do that in the next 6 minutes, right? And the way we're going to do is we're going to look at this inference for the existence of Ishvara. Just so we can say, this inference was around a long time, right? Again, it was debated and discussed and refined for certainly, 800 years, if not more. And the first question you should ask is, after we go over it, is, do you understand why anybody would debate this argument for 1,000 years? If it's obvious, please tell me why. But for me, I couldn't understand why anybody would spend 800 years debating this argument. So I knew that I was missing something, right? So let's first go through the argument, and then let's see whether you think it's worth debating for 800 years or whether you think it's a slam dunk, right? One way or the other. So this is, for those, I don't know how much background people have, so this will be terribly boring for some, and maybe not comprehensible to others. But if it's boring, raise your hands and I can go faster. And if it's not comprehensible, raise your hands and I can go a little slower. Okay, so I just don't know where everybody is here. This is a standard argument, right? It's a standard form in which Nyaya philosophers phrase their arguments. Buddhist philosophers, as you may know, only have two steps in an argument. And they think that the additional steps that Nyaya philosophers have are irrelevant, So the best way to think of this inference is as a certain kind of machine that's supposed to do something. This machine is supposed to produce in you knowledge, whatever that means, right? It's supposed to produce in you knowledge. The Buddhists, the Nayayikas think the machine has to have 5 moving parts. The Buddhists think it only needs to have 2 parts, right? It's one big difference. So this is the Nyaya version of this machine. And here's the argument. It says that our world, and this is called the site of the inference, or the paksha, right? It is that thing about which you have some doubt, or you have a question. And here, it's that our world was created by some intelligent maker. Let's just say some intelligent agent, you could say conscious agent, who has a mind, anything like that, right? The point is, this intelligent agent is the maker of the world. That's step one. It's a separate task to show that this intelligent maker is actually Ishvara, but that's down the road. This is step one. So step one, our world was created by an intelligent maker. Fine. Why? Step two, because it is an artifact or an effect, right? So all this means is that it's composed of parts, and those parts seem to have been put together or arranged, right? Saying it's an artifact, of course, you know, puts the cart before the horse in some sense, but it's an effect or an artifact. An effect with a certain kind of arrangement. That's called the reason property, or the hetu. Step three is all artifacts or effects are created by an intelligent maker, right? That's called pervasion or vyapti. There's an example that's always given, and that's here a pot, right? So why is a pot an example? A pot is an example because it is something that is known to be an effect, an artifact, and it is something that is known to have an intelligent maker, the potter. It's called a drishtanta. Then step four is our world is an artifact or effect. And step five, therefore, it was created by an intelligent maker. I'm just going to read all 5 steps, and then I want to know who's convinced by it. So our world was created by an intelligent maker because it is an artifact. All artifacts are created by an intelligent maker. For example, a pot. This world is an artifact. Therefore, our world was created by an intelligent maker. I trust that no one would be convinced by this on first blush, right? Would you think this is the kind of argument that people would spend centuries arguing about and debating? I take it from the response, the answer is no. That's exactly where you have to begin, because then we have to say, why did they do this? You have a couple answers. Either they were crazy, right? Or we're missing something really important. I suggest as a first pass, you assume it's the latter. And we're missing something really important. So we're going to try to figure out what that is. Because on the face of it, this doesn't... It's kind of... like, why? Okay. So let's first think about what kind of an argument is this? What is an argument? What is it supposed to do? Right? What they say is that basically this argument is linguistic in nature. Right? It's language. We're talking about it. We're sharing it. It's communicable. And it's supposed to produce in someone the awareness that our world was created by an intelligent maker. Right? And later that this maker is Ishvara. So the first thing is this, I want you to think of the argument like a machine that has parts, okay? The machine is to produce knowledge in you. So this is a knowledge-producing machine, a knowledge-producing instrument. So what are the moving parts, and how should we think of it, right? The standard way, a standard way in which it's interpreted in Sanskrit philosophy is on the following model. So we have this machine, right? And it has these 5 parts. And we want to know that if the machine works well, if it's well-functioning, it's going to produce knowledge in you. That's just the kind of machine it is. If it works well, it's going to produce knowledge in you. If it doesn't work well, it's not going to produce knowledge in you. Or if you have some defect in you, it may not work. Right? So let's take the standard example is an axe, right? So an axe, think of an axe. An axe is a kind of machine. What's its job? Its job is to cut, right? That's success. It's well-functioning if it cuts. What's necessary for it to function well? Let's think about it. It has to be sharp, right? It has to be sharp relative to the kind of tree it's trying to cut, right? What else?
It needs to be strong. It shouldn't break apart.
Yeah, the stick has to be a certain strength. If a stick is made of silly putty, or, you know, silly putty, it's not going to work, right?
It needs to be put together correctly.
It needs to be assembled correctly. But if I have a beautiful, fabulous axe right here on the table, it's not going to do anything. You also need to swing it, right? So you could say the axe has to have a person who's able to swing it in a proper way. But then that's adding a person to the whole thing. It just seems rather complicated. Let's see if we can make everything about this cutting machine just about the axe. So we could say the blade has to be sharp, has to be swung at a certain velocity, has to make contact at a certain angle, right? What else? It may be made of a certain kind of material. So if we think of Parimal swinging the axe as a machine, right? Everything that's relevant about making that machine work can be spoken about just in terms of the axe. Okay? Does that make sense? So this complicated machine of Parimal, his intentions, his swinging, etc., can all be boiled down to the axe, right? By saying properties of the axe. So same in the inference machine. In the inference machine, it's complicated. It's all these steps. But there's only one part that really... We can make one part the business end of this inference. And that business end is the reason property, the hetu. The hetu here is karyatvat, because it is an effect, because on account of its being an effect. So what that means is all the things that all the things that a well-functioning inference needs, right, I can simply talk about in terms of this reason property. Does that make sense? So instead of talking about Parimal being strong, I can say the axe makes contact with a certain kind of force, right? Instead of saying Parimal swinging it properly, I can say the axe has a certain velocity. Everyone get the idea? So this five-step machine is reduced to one essential part. That's called the instrument, really. And if that instrument has certain features, it'll necessarily cut the wood. And if it doesn't, it'll fail. So if it has certain defects, it won't work, right? Without those defects, it'll work, okay? It's a basic idea. Okay, so that's the moving part. So we can go into a little bit of detail about exactly how this works, just so you can see that there's more to it than merely my story of Parimal swinging the axe, all right? So this is on the last page, okay? Might be more than you need to know, but let's give it a whirl. Let's think about another inference machine, the standard one that everyone talks about, right? This fire and smoke. Is there anyone here who's not heard of the fire and smoke inference? Everyone knows about this, right? If we were to substitute it for the Ishwara inference, we would say there is fire on a mountain. Step one. Why? Because there is smoke. Wherever there is smoke, there is fire. Like in the hearth. There is fire here, therefore there's smoke here, therefore there is fire on the mountain. Okay? Remember, it's supposed to produce knowledge in us. So knowledge is something in our head, essentially. Alright? So how does that all work? This is a kind of nyaya story of how the structure of our thoughts works so that we can get knowledge. Alright? It's a little bit of a digression, but it's a part of the process of reasoning that people never really talk about, in part because there was this tragic decision to think that Indian theories of inference are actually like logic. And when you try to parse Indian theories of inference into first-order predicate logic and assume they're propositions, the whole thing falls apart. And so I think really, you know, I would say 50 years or 25 years at least of work was just going down the wrong road. And this is one way to keep in mind that's not the case. There are no propositions for Indian philosophers, and that's a good thing in my view. Everyone know what a proposition is? Again, and generally in your American philosophy and logic, you talk about knowledge in terms of beliefs, and belief is a kind of propositional attitude. So I believe that P is a proposition. I fear that P. I hope that P. P is an abstract state of affairs about which one can have attitudes. And it's ultimately propositions that are what knowledge and logic and semantics are about. But in this case, it's a little bit more different. So here's just how it goes, just to get an initial sense, and we'll see why this is important. So according to Nayakas, let's just talk just about the smoke, okay? Or just for now, the smoke that you see on the mountain. So when you see smoke, what does that mean? What does that mean? How do you explain that you see smoke? You have to explain that for the inference to work, right? You have to explain how you know wherever there is smoke, there is fire. You have to explain how you recall that wherever there is smoke, there is fire when you see smoke. And you have to explain what kind of fire it is that you infer when you say there's fire on that mountain, right? Because the fire that you infer is not any fire you actually saw, right? We talked about this on Monday. It's a generic fire. How does all that work? Right? Why should this good machine produce knowledge in you, produce something that's basically true, for lack of a better word for right now? This is just a part of the story to give you a sense that there is a story to tell here. So here's what the Nayakas say. They say, look, there's this real thing out there called smoke, and it is a causal constituent in the production of some kind of awareness in you, right? Perceptual awareness. Now, this awareness takes place in two steps. There's a non-conceptual awareness. Non-conceptual awareness is, for all practical purposes, useless for you. It's kind of the thing out there gets beamed into your head. It's not quite like that. Part of you goes out and brings it back, but it gets beamed into your head. It's there. You can't do anything with it. What that does is that produces a conceptual awareness. All right? So that conceptual awareness is usable. So if you imagine imagine the non-conceptual awareness is like an IOU that your friend gives you for £5, right? It's there, but it's kind of useless. No one else is going to accept this IOU, right? Then you have conceptual awareness. I don't know if this is going to work. I'm going to see where this gets me. Conceptual awareness is then a £5 note that you get, right? That's kind of usable. But this £5 note is interesting because you don't know that you have it. So, for example, you get the £5 IOU. That's non-conceptual awareness. Then when you're not looking, your friend takes the IOU and sticks the £5 note in your pocket, right? You have it, but you don't know that you have it. But you have it, right? That's conceptual awareness. That's you have the awareness. This is where the word awareness is funny, right? You have the awareness there's smoke on the mountain, but you don't notice that you have it. Just like you have a £5 note in your pocket, but you don't notice that you have a £5 note in your pocket. According to the Nayakas, you need to have some other cognition that helps you notice that you have a £5 note in your pocket, right? So that is called noticed conceptual awareness, all right? And that is that you are aware that there is smoke on the mountain. And so everything that you're aware of that you think of is this kind of awareness. So no, fine. I'm aware there's smoke on the mountain. I notice that there is smoke on the mountain. And then through a process that triggers a memory of this general statement, wherever there is smoke, there is fire. And then I get this next thing, this noticed conceptual awareness, there's fire on the mountain. Again, I'm skipping steps, right? Because you don't just get noticed conceptual awareness right away. You first have to get unnoticed and then noticed. But let's just forget that. So now we're aware there's fire on the mountain. So what's supposed to happen as a result of the inference is that you are aware, you have the thought, right? Ishwar is the maker of our world. You have the thought, there's fire on that mountain. Everyone has that thought if you follow the steps of the inference. But you don't believe it. You have doubt. I trust. Do you have doubt that Ishwar is the maker of the world on the base of that inference? So what do I have to do to get you to have knowledge? So in this world, doubt is not the same as a knowing about knowledge. Doubt is a different kind of awareness. It's not a knowing awareness event. It's just a doubt awareness event, and they're not the same. So I have to get rid of your doubt. Suppose I get rid of all your doubts. Then what? Then you know that there's fire on the mountain. You know there is, that Ishwar is the maker of our world. And then you have, so that process of removing doubt is one thing, right? I remove doubt through a process called certification. How do I remove doubt? Remember, we have a machine, we're jumping here back and forth. I got my inference machine. The business end is the hetu, right? All of your doubts are going to have to do with the hetu, right? All of your doubts are going to have to do with the key constituent of the instrument, which is this reason property. So you say, well, I have doubts. You know, you say that the axe is sharp enough, but, you know, come on, look at it. It looks really lame. It doesn't look sharp. And I'll say, here, let me show you. It is sharp. It really did cut. And I can take a piece of hair and, well, I take someone's hair and drop it, and it'll split, right? And that'll work. So I remove your doubts in a certain way. Once I remove your doubt, then you should say, yes, this machine must really work. It must cut it. That's the game. So what is necessary for making this work? Remember, I got a machine. I've boiled it down to one business part. The business end of this machine is one little component. and I have all these things about this component, basically all the ways in which this component could mess up, I enumerate. And we agree that there are five ways in which this component can, this part of the instrument can fail. And if I can then show you that none of these things actually apply, then you're forced to conclude that the machine works. And you're forced to conclude that the conclusion is true. Okay? So the trick is to identify all the possible defects that there could be for this instrument, and then systematically show you that none of them apply. Okay? That's the overall framework. And this framework is a framework that was pretty much agreed upon from Dignaga's time onward. Of course, that doesn't mean they agreed on anything, in a sense, except on the words and this basic framework. So we might disagree on what actually constitutes a defect, right? I might say, you know, that axe is purple. That's bad. You might say, what? That has nothing to do with whether it can cut. And I'll say, that's not what I think. I think if it's purple, it's not going to work. It's defective. Look, it's purple. So then before we can get back to our main task, we got to go off to the side and fight about whether purple is really a defect for an axe blade. Right? So we do that, and we come back, and I say, okay, you're right. Purple has nothing to do with it. And I'll say, oh, it was made in Cleveland. They're really bad at making axe blades in Cleveland. And, you know, you get the idea. But interestingly, there was a remarkable level of agreement regarding what the defects were, basically. Okay. So why did I go through this? This is simply to say that according to the mental events that sequentially occur that result in a knowing event, is this what prevents a knowing event from occurring is the fact of doubt. And so by eliminating doubt, and the way of eliminating doubt is in a way to show that none of the known defects of an instrument apply, we can basically clear the way for knowledge to occur. Right, that's the overall structure. Okay, back to our story. All right, so where are we here? Okay, let's just take one more part of our Nyaya story first. Suppose I say, do you see this pencil? You all say yes. I say, what color is it? You say, oh, it's black, right? I say, what is that? You say, it's a flower. I say, what color is it? You say, oh, well, it's pink and yellow. Is that knowledge? Do you have knowledge that this is black? Do you? Who doesn't have knowledge that it's at least in part black? Everyone has knowledge? Do you have any doubt? Oh. So if you have no doubt, then what about the machine that produced it? What's the machine? The machine there is perception, sense perception. But you didn't have to certify it. Remember, certifying is the process of showing that the instrument that produced a knowing event is well-functioning. The way you show an inference is well-functioning, the way you certify it, is by showing that none of the possible doubt, none of the possible defects that could affect it, in fact, apply. Right? But just now, no one certified anything. Why not? How come you want me to certify this Ishwara thing, but you don't make me certify this? Seems terribly unfair. Why? Well, or the smoke fire inference. How many think that if you see smoke, well, it's a little complicated, smoke and fire. Suppose you, it can be. I'll take that back. I'll stick with my pen. Pencil. Why? The point is, you don't always have to certify something. Most of the things you're aware of, you don't bother certifying. The only reason to certify something is if there is some kind of doubt. Otherwise, this is good enough. This works for you. So who cares? If I said, do you see my pencil? Someone says, yes, yes. And Professor Flood says, hey, you know, that's a pen. Now what do we have to do? Now we have doubt, right? He's closer to me. We have doubt. So then we have to do some certification process, right? Otherwise, nobody cares. Okay? So most of our knowledge is a bad word, but I'm just going to use it. Most of our knowledge is involuntary. Right? I mean, we see things all the time. We negotiate the world all the time. We have thoughts. We make inferences all the time. We do it automatically. We're not even aware of it. We're not even aware we have it. We're not even aware we do it. We certainly don't certify it. So this is for very special cases, right? This whole process. Okay, that's the last bit of this inference stuff. Okay, so now we're going to be Nyaya philosophers, right? We've put forth our inference, right? And from looking at the faces of our colleagues, we are very, it's very evident to us that they have doubt, right? It's not like the pencil case. They don't have the same like smile. They kind of like, this is crazy, right? So what's our first task? We have an epistemic obligation to do something. We have an epistemic obligation to show our conversation partner that none of the defects apply. So when I, as a Nyayika, offer an argument, what I must do is present the inference and also show that none of the defects that I think you think might apply, apply. All right? So that's the first thing to do. So when I say, what does it mean to defend an argument, right? The first question you ask is, when is it necessary to defend it? We just talked about with the pen. It's necessary when there's doubt raised, whether you have doubt or someone raises doubt. Because my goal in sharing the inference with you, I already am convinced. It's to convince you. So what matters is not my doubt. I don't have any, but if I did, it's irrelevant. It's your doubt. So the very fact that you have doubt is enough for me to have to do my work, right? So the second thing that this whole framework really shows is that, you know, people have often asked about the form of Indian philosophical texts, right? The so-called dialogical format. And you get all kinds of people wax poetically about what this says and the significance of it. You know, oh, isn't it nice? People talk to each other. It's so much better than what we do today. Blah, 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 blah. Sorry, I don't mean blah, blah, blah in that dismissive sense. One thing that I don't think people fully realize is the dialogical format is actually of great epistemic significance. Because the dialogical format parallels exactly right the overall epistemic framework of the arguments. If the arguments are about, let's say in the Nyaya case, removing doubt. The purpose of the argument is to convince someone else. The way you convince them is by removing doubt and showing the inference that the instrument works. To remove doubt, you have to remove their doubt. Not generic doubt, but their actual doubt. To remove their actual doubt, you have to know what their actual doubts are. And so there's no way to get that other than really a genuinely dialogical format, right? Imagine if rhetorically I can say my opponent has this doubt. Look, she says it. That's not merely rhetorical. It actually has epistemic force with the structure of the epistemology. So I think it's more than merely a nice narrative framework for philosophical argument. I think it's actually, it has a much deeper connection with the structure of the epistemology. That isn't to say you can't rewrite the whole thing out, but it'll be a very different kind of thing, is my sense. Okay. So then, how do we defend an inferential argument? We already talked about this, so we can go this pretty quickly. You want to ask if the reason property, what's the reason property? The reason property is the hetu. The hetu is because it's an effect. This is the essential functioning constituent of the inference. You want to show that it's well functioning, right? That's how you defend it. And the way you do that is you say that none of the possible defects that could apply to it, in fact, apply to it. And why is showing that none of the possible defects apply thought to be sufficient? Because those are the only ways in which the inference couldn't work. I mean, the way in which the machine might not produce its output. The only ways. So if you can show that none of them apply, then, well, the machine produces output, whether you are happy about it or not. Right? Okay. And I said that we're using this term certification, which is the way of showing that none of the defects that could apply to the instrument, in fact, apply to the instrument. All right? Okay. So now, we have this, I said we have this reason property, right? This reason property is the essential part of the inference. Reason properties are also structured. They have two subcomponents that constitute them, all right? Let's say one is called the site subcomponent, and one is called the pervasion subcomponent. So I'll explain what that is in a second. All right. So we have our instrument, the reason property. It really has two parts. It has a site subcomponent and a pervasion subcomponent. For those who work on this stuff, the site subcomponent is basically paksha dharmata, and the pervasion subcomponent is vyapti. All right. These two subcomponents, for those who know, who do some of this, they're the trairupya conditions, the so-called triple conditions, right? Okay. Is there anyone who knows these terms already, other than Professor Flood and a little bit? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So what I want to do is, so now I have factored it out. I factored out I've reduced my machine to one key constituent instrument called the reason property. I've now factored my reason property into two parts, the site subcomponent and the pervasion subcomponent. So that means all the defects that apply to either the site subcomponent or the pervasion subcomponent, right? Because there are no other subcomponents. That's how it works. So we want to figure out what these defects are. Okay? We're going to talk about basically just two or three. According to the Buddhists, there are only three defects. According to Nyayikas, there are basically five defects. The small number should never comfort you, because as you all know from studying Sanskrit, small numbers usually mean there's hidden structures, right? So you may have three types, but this type has 17 subtypes, etc., etc. But there are three broad categories for Buddhists and five broad categories for Nyayikas, and you can basically, there's a translation function between them, more or less. One of the key things for studying differences between various philosophical and theological systems is, again, we talked last time about how in Indian philosophy you have to look in all the wrong places to find the good stuff. This is one of those places. No one thinks to compare the lists of defects. But there are some defects that the Nyaya philosophers think are defects that the Buddhists don't, and vice versa. And if you understand exactly why a Nyayika thinks that a purple axe is a defect, and a Buddhist philosopher thinks that one made in Cleveland is a defect, you've understood something central to how they understand what an argument is and how it works. And guess what? That affects the kinds of machines you can build and what those machines can do. So it's this kind of topic where really cool things happen, but it's really tedious. So you have to be really well motivated and do it first thing in the morning. Remember what this is actually all about, because otherwise, trust me, it's not easy going always. Okay, so what are we doing now? We're looking at the two subcomponents and the kinds of defects that could apply to it. Okay, so the first is, and again, why are we doing this? We're doing this because we're trying to learn a little bit about how to think like philosophers from Vikramashila. How did they think? How did they argue? That's what we're trying to do as best we can. So the first is the site subcomponent. And here's how that goes. The site subcomponent, to show that... Okay, so the site subcomponent can have defects, right? The pervasion subcomponent can have defects. One defect that you can have in the site subcomponent is called swarupa asiddha. So there's many ways of interpreting swarupa asiddha. Let's just say that... let's just say this. Here we go. So in our smoke inference, right, we have our machine. What's our machine in the smoke fire inference? Remember? There's fire on the mountain because there is smoke. That's the reason property, right? In our Ishvara inference, what is it? Because the world is an effect, because it is an effect. So we have smoke and effect. In order for my one way this could be defective, let's stick with fire and smoke, it might be easier initially. One way in which my machine might be defective is if smoke is not present in the site. So I want to say there is fire on the mountain because there is smoke. Wherever there is smoke, there's fire. Wherever there is smoke, there's fire. So if the smoke can be shown not to exist on the mountain, then game's up, right? It's over. I cannot conclude that there's fire on that mountain. Is that okay? So one possible defect is that the smoke, the reason property, is not present in the sight, either because of something about this or because the sight isn't there.
Okay.
Now, that's one kind of defect. It gets a little more interesting. Let's take the Ishvara argument, right? What's my machine? My machine is because it is an effect, right? And I say that this effect needs to be present in our world. You can imagine the kinds of debates you have about that. That's all about, well, what constitutes an effect? How do you define it? Fine, the world has parts, right? Is that enough for it to be an effect? So those kind of conversations take place here under the rubric of this defect, Surupa Sitta. Another thing that happens from this is something else of importance with the Ishvara inference. Look, my instrument is simply because it is an effect. Suppose that works. What I conclude from that is that there is an intelligent agent, right? There is an agent, let's say. Now, that doesn't help me, right? There's a lot of answer agents. Human beings are agents. Ishvara seems like a special agent. How do I know that it's Ishvara and not just an ant or something else? One other thing that happens with this move, that the reason property has to be present in the sight, is that people then try to say, look, the only kind of a reason property that could be present in the sight is of a certain sort. And that certain sort allows you to extend out from a simple agent to a more complex agent. We'll come to that. I just wanted to leave you with that thought. Okay, sight subcomponent. Done. Next is the pervasion subcomponent. And the issue here is, what is pervasion, right? Pervasion is this rule of vyapti. It's supposed to be this general statement. In our smoke-fire thing, it's wherever there's smoke, wherever there's fire, there's smoke, right? And in the Ishvara inference, that all effects are created by an intelligent agent, right? If I get these backwards, just let me know. So what are the defects? What defects could we have here? There are two main classes of defects. One is called opposed, and one is called inconclusive. So let's look at opposed. So remember, what am I doing now? We're all Nayayikas. We're trying to show our opponents that Ishvara exists. So we've given the inference. They are unimpressed. We're now going through and showing that none of the possible defects apply. We show that the first defect doesn't apply. We're now going to go look at this other one, which is opposed. And to show that opposed doesn't apply, you have to show that the reason property is present in at least one similar case. You have to show the reason property is present in at least one similar case. That is, a locus in which the target property is present. For example, a pot. What's up with that, right? So, and there are two issues that come up in this, right? So I have my argument. Let's take the Ishvara argument. So I need to show that it's present in a similar case. Why? We understood why it had to be present in the sight, right? Is that okay? Why does it have to be present in a similar case? Let's see. Fire in the mountain, fine, because there's smoke, okay. Wherever there is smoke, there is fire. Just like in the kitchen. Or whatever is an effect has an intelligent agent, just like a pot. Okay. Is that good enough to show that, okay, well, I'll say pot, potter, right? An effect. So the pot is a similar case. It's a place that I know is produced by an intelligent agent, right? And that is an effect. So it's okay? I say that. But someone says, look, no offense, Rip, but he's not the kind of agent we're interested in. Right? We're interested in a different kind of agent. He's not omniscient, as far as I know. Let's assume he's not omniscient. All right? So you haven't met your obligation to show that the defect doesn't apply, because all you succeeded in showing is that this reason property is present in something that has an agent. You need to show that is present in something that has an omniscient agent. But you haven't done that. So you haven't met your obligation. So that has to do with the scope of the target property, right? What makes something a similar case? What makes something a similar case is if it's known to have the target property. What's a target property? An intelligent agent. Or is it omniscient agent? If it's an intelligent agent, I win, right? I can move on. If it's an omniscient agent, I'm kind of in trouble, right? So I say, look, you know, that's all well and good, but I just need to show it's an intelligent agent. I can show you that he's omniscient later. All I need is for you to understand that all effects are created by an intelligent agent, and the earth has an intelligent agent. Or a conscious agent, or some kind of agent. The omniscient part, that's, don't worry about that. That's a separate argument. We'll get there later. So please don't worry, Mr. Opponent. Okay. The other part of this similar case, it seems tedious, but the idea is that this is where the philosophical issues get discussed. So we have this silly idea of what's a similar case. Well, we know the target property has to be present there, and the reason property has to be present there. We talked about the target property, right? Target property being just an agent, or an intelligent agent, or an omniscient agent. What about the reason property? It seems so innocent, because it is an effect. Well, is that really the reason property? Or is the reason property all effects? Or is it just some effects? So, for example, a pot, fine, but a pot isn't any old effect. And a pot is an effect, the agent of which I have seen at some point in the past. Or a pot is the kind of thing that I've seen to have an agent. So, Mr. Nayaka, you're playing fast and loose here. You claim that this is a similar case because it is an effect. I agree it's an effect. You also claim that it's a similar case because the target property, an agent, is present there. But this is because you're playing around with the scope of these terms. You're not entitled to claim that. All you're entitled to claim is that this is not any old effect. This is a restricted class of effects. This is an effect that you have seen. This is a kind of effect that you have seen to have. That you've seen one token has a intelligent agent, and the kind of agent you're talking about is intelligent but not omniscient. You see how this goes? So now this issue of the similar case becomes an issue of the scope. Okay, but I meet my epistemic obligation. I move on. We got one more defect, then we'll get to the counter arguments. So generally, this is another defect called generally inconclusive. And here's how this goes. So just to say, this conversation that we've been having over the last 5 minutes about this defect H2 can go on for 20 pages. And you can see why. It's really important. But it's something that people just don't pay attention to because it's really dull. It's truly dull. Unless you already supply the context for it. And that's because we, general people who come to this material later, don't yet know. We're not very good at reading from the inside out fully. We don't see everything that we're supposed to see when we first encounter these texts. And so we tend to dismiss lists. We tend to dismiss discussions of these defects. We tend to think, oh God, again about general and restricted classes of effects. But if you think yourself into the problem, you've got to imagine yourself actually debating these issues and care about it and think your way into these texts, then you'll have no problem. There's a reason, again, they exist. There's a reason this stuff was written, and you can't dismiss it until you figure out why. That's the basic hermeneutic imperative, let's say. We should have that, a hermeneutic imperative, instead of merely the Kantian ones. Anyway, let's keep going. So one more defect. It's called generally inconclusive. This is the one that everyone talks about. So to show that this defect doesn't apply, you have to show that a reason property, what they say is that it's exclusive. Can we open that a little bit? It's kind of high. That the reason property, maybe a little loud. Is everyone else hot?
Yeah.
that's an English center, but no one I hear going in ever speaks English. I guess that's...
More federation.
It's...
Can we infer an English school from the...
Right.
Non-English speaking
world. Okay, enough of that. So you have to show the reason property is excluded from all dissimilar cases. Okay, let's see what that's what that means. Okay. All right, back to my reason property in the fire inference. Smoke. Right? Target property. Fire. Right? Similar case is a place where you know the target property is present, that is, where fire is present, and you know the reason property is present. Smoke. Our example, the hearth, right? An old-style kitchen that actually had smoke, right? Ishwood inference. All right. Reason property, effect, being an effect. Target property, intelligent agent. Similar case, pot. Dissimilar case? A dissimilar case would be a place or some kind of a locus where the reason property is known to be present that is an effect, right, that is an effect, but doesn't have, but is known not to have an intelligent maker. Right, that would be a dissimilar case. That would be a counterexample to my general statement, right?
Falsification.
Yeah, it would defeat it. Does that make sense? Because my, remember, it has to be the case that all effects are created by an agent. If I can find an effect, just one, that isn't created by an agent, the whole thing is done. So in order for me to meet my epistemic obligation, I need to demonstrate to you, who still has doubt, sadly, that my reason property, being an effect, is not present in any dissimilar case. Right? Okay. So I am going to show you, I'm going to say, look, you probably think, you know, like growing grass or a tree is an example of a dissimilar case, right? Because look, growing grass and trees are effects. I don't see any agent. So you might think that this is a problem for me. I'm very happy to say this is not a problem for me at all. Because I have to ask you, how do you know? Why are you so sure it doesn't have an agent? And you say, well, I never saw one. I say, oh, how do you know the agent wasn't on holiday? I say, well, I don't. I say, well, why are you so sure? Well, I guess I'm not. I say, oh, so you have doubt about this now? Can you prove to me this that this is really a counterexample? And with better arguments than those, right? So there's this idea that maybe the agent's remote, either temporally remote, spatially remote, or by its very nature, remote. If you can't prove to me that you know, then you have doubt about it. And if you have doubt about it, then it can't really be a counterexample. So actually, this thing that you claim to have doubt about should actually be part of the site of our inference, right? Remember, the site of our inference is supposed to, is in this case, our world, or things in our world, or our world as a whole, but it also includes all those things about which we have doubt regarding whether they have an intelligent maker, right? So we have doubt about our world, and you didn't think you had doubt about a tree or growing grass, but through my argument, which I didn't give you in full, you have doubt, so then, I'm sorry, it's not a counterexample, goes in the site. Okay? So I've met my obligation. It doesn't defeat it. You can see it all depends on how these side arguments go, right? This is the overall structure. You say, oh, I say, oh, it gets complicated who I am, right? So I'm still a Nayaka. And then you say to me, okay, yeah, look, you know, I agree. I really can't prove to you that growing grass is a counterexample. But, you know, I still have doubt. I can't be sure. I was sure before with my growing grass. But, you know, I have doubt. I mean, you haven't convinced me that you know it's excluded from all dissimilar cases. So this kind of doubt undermines your instrument. And undermining your instrument is just as bad as defeating it. It doesn't work. Right? It undermines it. Like, you know, I'm not going to be convinced. It undermines it. Oh. So then, how do we deal with undermining? I'll say, well, You have doubt. Tell me about your doubt. Do you doubt that this was made by an intelligent maker? Or you doubt that... what is your doubt about, really? I mean, you basically, what I'm saying when I doubt it, or what you're saying when you doubt it, is that, look, there's some potential counterexample out there. I'm not convinced there's no counterexample out there. That's what you're basically saying, right? Because if you had any specific one about which you had doubt, that would be in the site. So you say, okay, there's got to be one out there you haven't convinced me. And I'll say, okay, show me a candidate. Once you show me a candidate, you're done, right? Once you show me a candidate that you have doubt about, then I can say that should be in the site. That's something we're debating. That's not something you're sure about. So now we have to have a whole theory of doubt, right, also. And we'll get to that. So anyway, what have I done? I haven't done it in the right voice because I've done it by going back and forth. But what I've tried to do is show you a little bit about what some of the defects are and the way in which I feel I've met my epistemic obligation. Right? If I didn't give you the Buddhist back and forth, or the back and forth, you might have been more convinced that I met my epistemic obligation. Right? So if I had been a better actor and told the story in the right way, I would have just played one part. And I'd have played the part of a Nayayika. And I'd have said, we agree these are these defects. I will show you none of them apply. None of them apply. And so now, your thought that Ishvara is the maker of the world must be knowledge. Unless you have some specific further doubt. And I'm happy to address that. Okay. And the Buddha... So now, that's basically how that part goes, all right? Now we'll get into the counter-arguments, and I've tried to write these out a bit. We may not do all of them, at least do one or two of them. Because what we want to do is... We're not going to get to do all of them at all, but... 4:15... I'm going to finish the story, and I'm going to get to the conclusion. And what I want us to ask is, what is this debate actually about? Is it about Ishvara? Well, on the one hand, yes. But what is it about? Is it really Ishvara that exercised everyone for this long? Or is it other things as well? What is this debate actually about? What are the fundamental philosophical issues at stake in this debate? And what do we learn about the debate and about all these debates by focusing on them? So that's what I want to try to get to some degree, right? Okay, see if we can do this. Okay, fine. So let's go back to our pervasion subcomponent, right? This is the pervasion is wherever there is smoke, there is fire. All effects are created by an intelligent agent. And when Buddhists critique this argument, they begin by the undermining argument, right? Remember we said, look, I'm not convinced with the way you prove that wherever there is an effect, all effects are created by an intelligent agent, so I think there could be some possible locus of doubt out there. And therefore, I'm not going there with you, with the Ishvara bit. So here's the Nyaya part. I'll just try to read it. And then I'll read you the Buddhist part. This is just a kind of attempt at summarizing it. Maybe we'll just do this one and let me see what issues. Yeah, let's see if we just do. Let's see how far we get. Okay. So here's how the Nayayika tries to meet his epistemic obligation to show you that this particular defect at the subcomponent doesn't apply. And this is the doubt about the exclusion of the reason property from all dissimilar cases. All right? Here's how it goes. So then he says, look, the possibility of there being a dissimilar case, right, a counterexample, which has not yet been identified, does not result in epistemically significant doubt. Why? Well, doubt, like all awareness events, what's awareness event? A cognition. Must have a specific and identifiable object, property possessor, or locus. Moreover, this doubt, this locus, must be one about which it is not known whether a particular property is present. In the context of an inferential argument, this locus must be a specific and identifiable potential dissimilar case, in which it is not known whether the reason property is present. An unobserved or unidentified dissimilar case cannot be a locus of doubt. This is I touched on some of this, right? If an unobserved or unidentified dissimilar case could be a locus of doubt, inferential awareness would be fatally undermined, and rational people could not act on the basis of it. Why is that? Well, it's kind of like a four-year-old who says, well, why not? Why not? Why not? Why not? Why not? Right? So I'll say, you'll say, look, I know there's one out there somewhere. And I'll say, where? So, well, you know, I don't know. Somewhere. It's not in Oxford. Maybe it's in Cambridge. It's somewhere. So the Nayaka says, look, that kind of doubt isn't epistemically significant. That's just not worth paying attention to. That's idle. So if you want to have real doubt, it must be doubt about something. You tell me about that thing, we'll go investigate. You tell me it's some vague thing out there, you don't know where, you don't know what it looks like, anything, I'm sorry. I'm not impressed. And you shouldn't be either. Right? Okay. So he says, however, if this is not the case, and so unlocalized doubt, right, that is doubt that does not have a specific and identifiable object, sorry, that kind of doubt cannot be epistemically significant, right? So Mr. Buddhist, your kind of weird skeptical doubt, that's not a threat. And he says, consider the following inference. Look, people live long and healthy lives because they eat nutritious food. Right? We all know that in order to live a long and healthy life, one should eat well, and so we do our best to do so. We do so even though we also know that there may be, and there in fact are, people who eat well but do not live long and healthy lives. If such an unobserved, an unidentified person could be an epistemically significant locus of doubt, the inference would be fatally undermined, and rational people would not act on the basis of it. But rational people do and should act on the basis of it. And so this kind of unlocalized doubt cannot be epistemically significant. Only localized doubt is epistemically significant. So unless a Buddhist can point to a specific dissimilar case in which the reason property is present, a case of localized doubt, there isn't epistemically significant doubt about the exclusion of the reason property from all dissimilar cases. That's what the Nayaka says. Buddhists come back and says, not so fast. So, Ratnakirti, this particular Buddhist, agrees with his Nyaya opponent that unlocalized doubt is not epistemically significant, since, as his opponent says, accepting that it is the case would what he calls the ghost of paralyzing doubt. Even well-known inferences would be fatally undermined. Right? Ratnakirti disagrees with his opponent, however, on how to understand what localized and unlocalized doubt consist in. Unlike his opponent, who thinks that localized doubt is doubt about whether a particular property is present in a specific and identifiable locus, Ratnakirti argues that localized doubt is actually doubt about whether a particular property is present in some locus, even if that locus has not yet been observed and identified. Unlocalized doubt is, for him, doubt that is not directed toward a locus at all. Unlocalized doubt is, for him, doubt that is not directed toward a locus at all, right? So what the bad kind of doubt, unlocalized doubt is just some vague doubt like, no, no, I don't think so. But if it's, there must be some property possessor that does or does not have this, that he thinks is okay. Precisely what the Nayaka thought was not okay. 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 Thus, according to Ratnakirti, it is only when there is a source of knowledge that can prove... Wait, did I miss something? Sorry. Oh, yeah, here we go. This is the first paragraph. Right, unlocalized doubt is for him doubt that is not directed toward a locus at all. Since this kind of doubt can be raised even in the case of universally accepted inferences, it is epistemically insignificant, right? So even in the fire-smoke inference, you can say, how, why, etc., etc., idle. So he agrees. Unlike his Nyaya opponent, however, Ratnakirti does not think that if an unobserved and unidentified dissimilar case could be a locus of doubt, inferential reason would always be fatally undermined, such that rational people would not act on the basis of it. Okay? Remember, that was the big plug for the Nayaka. If you think this, you're never going to act, because you can always raise this. Ratnakirti says, no, not so fast. It's a different way of thinking about it. There's a better criteria for determining when localized and epistemically significant doubt undermines rational action. Here's what he says. He insists that when there isn't a source of knowledge, we're fighting about what constitutes epistemically significant doubt. If you're going to decide who wins the Ishwara inference, you better have a theory of epistemically significant doubt. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to philosophically resolve this, right? Okay, let's keep going. He insists that when there isn't a source of knowledge that can prove or disprove that a particular property is or is not present in some locus, the epistemically significant doubt that results does not undermine rational action. So, look, there's two kinds of epistemically significant doubt. One kind that undermines rational action, and one kind that doesn't. So if there is a source of knowledge that could tell you whether or not a particular locus had a particular property, then that kind of epistemic, but you don't know, or you that kind of doubt is significant. You shouldn't act on the basis of it. But suppose there is no source of knowledge that can tell you one way or the other what's the case. If there is no source of knowledge that can tell you one way or the other, well, then you shouldn't expect one. You shouldn't. Your action cannot be motivated or cannot be based on there being such a source of knowledge because there isn't one. So in that case, that kind of doubt is still okay for action. And he says the long life inference is just that kind of a thing. The long life inference is not really an inference. There is no source of knowledge that can prove, right, that eating healthy and nutritious food is going to lead to a long life. Perception doesn't do it. Inference doesn't do it, because that's an effect-cause inference. Not a, remember, smoke and fire is from what to what, right? You're inferring there's fire, you're inferring fire, which is the cause, on the basis of smoke, which is the effect. In the long life inference, you're trying to make infer something the other way around. So right in the case is, look, that's not really an inference. And so therefore, there is no source of knowledge that can prove this or not. And so there are, obviously, rational people should act on the basis of whatever they want. And, you know, this isn't really a source of knowledge, but we act all the time on things that aren't knowledge, that isn't knowledge. So, tough for you, right, basically. Okay. So the point is that Ratnakirti says, that this Buddhists say, that rational people can't act on the basis of doubt. That's, this conversation was all about, remember, this is all about one part of one defect for this instrument. And I'm going to do one more important part, and then we're going to end. We're going to get to the conclusion. We'll skip over the growing grass thing. Actually, let's do growing grass, and we'll skip the site subcomponent. Let's do growing grass. Okay. So take about 5 minutes, then we'll get to the conclusion. So do you remember this? This was, the Nayaka had tried to say that growing grass is not a counterexample. And use this move of you know, remoteness was the theory. So here's how it goes. So now the Buddha says, look, Mr. Nayaka, your bizarre strategy of trying to show me that growing grass is not a counterexample, because I can't prove to you it's a counterexample, is really not cool. That does not work. Here's what I have to say about that, all right? You know, basically, you just keep stuffing stuff in the sight of the inference. Anytime I propose a putative counterexample, you're going to say, how do you prove it? And if I can't, you're going to make it go back in the sight and say it isn't really a counterexample. That is just not cool. I'm not buying that, right? So he has to have some response. And here's how it goes. Because look, Ratnakirti argues that if the Nayikas suppose that Ishvara is observable, then it can be shown through a kind of perception called a non-apprehension of an observable, that trees and growing grass are instances of deviation, that is, they're counterexamples, and therefore that they defeat the pervasion subcomponent of the instrument. So he says, look, if Ishvara is supposed to be observable, I definitely can prove to you that growing grass is a counterexample. You want to prove it? Look, here's a pot, here's some water, here's some seeds, here's the sun, here's some water, there's food coming, let's wait. Right? Okay. Now, the reason for, and the Nayaka would agree with this. This is because, according to both of them, the epistemic fact of not observing an observable object in a locus, what does that mean? The epistemic fact, okay, some cognitive fact, of not observing something that she should be able to observe in a locus, establishes the non-epistemic fact of its absence. Okay, so the epistemic fact, I have some cognitive process, right, that tells me that I should be able to see something somewhere at a certain time under certain conditions. If I don't, I'm allowed to conclude not just that I don't see it, but that it does not exist there. Right? Okay. So they both agree, they're happy with that. If Ishvara is supposed to be unobservable, however, Ratnakirti argues Nayikas cannot prove negative concomitance through non-apprehension, as required by their theory. We can skip that for now. This is because, as Ratnakirti argues, the epistemic fact, right, the cognition, cognitive process, of not observing an unobservable cannot establish the non-epistemic fact of the absence of that unobservable. That's, okay? If the thing can't be seen anyways, whether it's there or not, then not seeing it there isn't going to tell me anything about whether it is there. Right? So according to Ratnakirti, a finite, an unspecified number of non-observations can never establish the absence of an unobservable object. All right? Okay. I mean, what we've done just very briefly and really at the surface is look at the overall structure of the Nyaya inference machine. And we could do the same thing for a Buddhist inference machine. We've looked at what this machine is supposed to do and how Nyayikas and Buddhists believe it's supposed to do that. We've talked about defects. We've tried to show just a very little and very briefly how these defects can affect the functioning of this instrument and how by certifying the instrument, showing that it's well-functioning, by showing that the defects don't apply, we can basically convince our opponent that the machine functions well, and therefore they're just forced to accept the conclusion, right? That's sort of the general strategy. We've done it in a very brief and skeletal way, but I've tried to do it in the vocabulary that they used so we'd understand how they actually thought about it. It's way too quick and way too fast, but it's more to leave you with an impression and a taste, right? What I want to conclude is, I want to conclude with a little bit about what, how we're going to actually make it, I think. Yeah. Yeah, we will. About what this debate is about, right? Let's just think about what we've talked about. If you're interested in, suppose you're in the philosophy faculty, and you hear this argument, what is it about? Well, it's about Ishvara because it's supposed to be about Ishvara. What are the fundamental philosophical issues? Suppose we as a group have to decide in the next 13 minutes if these two defects apply, right? Let's say the defect of there being doubt about the if I cannot show you there is no counterexample, that's a defect, right? One defect. Let's see if we can decide what we have to know to figure out if that's a defect or not. Can we decide that issue in the next 13 minutes for ourselves? Just that one. Let me read a little bit and see if that gets us somewhere. What's the question we have to answer? If the mission impossible is to decide that question, right, that issue of the presence of this defect, and I give you not 20 questions, but I give you one question. I'll give you the answer to it. What is the one question you ask? What prior philosophical question do you have to resolve in order to be able to answer this question about counterexamples? We saw that in our discussion we had something about the epistemology of absences, right? Some kind of theory of doubt. There's other kinds of issues here. I think of it in terms of, there's another issue that's hidden here that we didn't talk about that's really important, and it's the issue of fallibility and epistemic risk. I'll tell you what that's about. So, recall the growing grass argument, remember? And the argument from localized doubt, right? About, remember those basically? In both arguments, what's at issue is negative concomitance. Vyatireka vyapti. How one can show, right, that the reason property is excluded from all dissimilar cases. Essentially, how one can show there is no counterexample. How one can show there is no effect that does not have an intelligent agent. How one can show, right, there is nothing. Right, everyone gets the idea, okay. So, here's where one of the main issues comes down. According to Nayayikas, it's sufficient to show on the basis of observation and non-observation that there are no known counterexamples. The Nayikas say, look, I've met my epistemic obligation by showing you that there are no known counterexamples. For Ratnakirti, on the other hand, the burden of proof is much higher. He insists that one must know that there are no counterexamples. Tanayaka says, in order to show the defect doesn't apply, I must show you there are no known counterexamples. That makes sense of his theory of doubt, doesn't it? Ratnakirti says, no. The burden is much higher. You must know there are no counterexamples. The Nayakas recognize their theory is fallible, right? So if I as a Nayaka can say, I have to show there are no known counterexamples, you could say there could be one. I could say yes. So, that's not a problem. So, the epistemic burden I have to meet is much lower, right? Ratnakirti has to show that he knows there are no counterexamples, even for his own inferences, right? Okay. So the Nayakas recognize their theory is fallible, but they insist that the higher level of epistemic risk that follows from this is not only acceptable, but inevitable. In contrast, Ratnakirti argues that fallibility is not acceptable and hardly inevitable, since, like his predecessors, he argues that inference-warranting relations must be instances of what's either called a production mode, tadutpati, it's called, or identity mode, tadatvya, both of which are law-like relations. So the basic idea is that for Buddhists, they believe you can only make good inferences. The inference machine only functions when this pervasion subcomponent is basically a law-like relation, either a causal one or a so-called identity relation. Now, I could say that's really nuts, because then you can infer almost nothing, and it's useless. So you have to have a more liberal understanding of the pervasion subcomponent, and that just means that it's going to be fallible. But that's not really that big a deal, right? Okay. So one fundamental issue that is at stake in this debate is the issue of epistemic risk. How much epistemic risk are you willing to have in your theory of inference? If you're a Buddhist and you tolerate no risk, right, guess what? You can't prove very much. The lower the burden, the more you can prove. And it's with this lower burden that you get Ishvara. The critique here is that, look, Mr. Ratnakirti, it's all well and good for you to say you have to have a higher burden of proof, but the fact is you can't meet your own burden of proof. So if you can't meet your own burden of proof, your whole theory's out the window too. You're basically forced down to my level. So one question that we have to answer, if we're going to decide this, is how do we decide, philosophically, what an acceptable amount of epistemic risk is? How do you argue for the amount of epistemic risk you can tolerate? Without that argument, you're not going to, without a philosophical perspective on that, you're not going to get anywhere in evaluating this argument. That's not an easy question. You're also going to have a very sophisticated theory of the epistemology of absences. Right? That's also not quite as easy as it seems. You're also going to have an account of mental events and the way they're structured. Right? Let me give you an example of that. Let's take a smoke fire inference again for the Buddhist. Look, the Buddhist says you have to, for an inference to work, you have to have a law-like relation between the terms. So wherever there is smoke, there is fire, has to be universal. Right? How do you know wherever there is smoke, there is fire? Well, you say, look, it's a causal relation. It's an invariable causal relation. Okay. How do you know that? How do you prove there's a causal relation? To do that, you have to somehow be able to think that all, right, is produced by all. The Buddha says, oh, we have no problem doing that. We can do that. How? We just look at it. We look around. We do a finite number of observations, and then we can conclude all. What? You don't believe in universals. How do you do that? Does everyone get the idea? If I say, look, I see smoke and fire, there's a particular structure to it, which you don't need to get into it. I see smoke here, I see fire here. When I don't see fire, I don't see smoke, blah, 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 blah. I get this general relation. That's based on a finite number of observations. How, on the basis of this finite number of observations, do you come to this universal statement? If the Buddhist can't show how he does that, there's no reason for the Nyayika to have to accept this higher burden of proof. This higher burden of proof is entirely dependent upon the Buddhist being able to make good. The way the Buddhist makes good on this comes at a very high philosophical price. The Buddhist makes good on this through what's called the theory of exclusion, the theory of apoha. And the theory of apoha is basically how, on the basis of seeing one thing, you can think of all things. So how, on the basis of seeing a token of a type, you can come to be aware of the type. If you can do that, then you can get all, right? If you can't do that, this higher burden is tough to meet. So, I guess, so the, what this comes to that is the final point here, that what this whole thing depends upon is actually very substantive, very difficult, and very important philosophical questions. This issue of epistemic risk, or this issue of epistemology of absences, or this issue of how people meet burdens of proof and shifting burdens of proof, is not easy. It's also not on the surface of these texts. So the texts don't say, what this debate is about is Ishvara. To resolve this debate, you first have to know what your level of epistemic risk is. You have to know how you establish general statements, etc., etc. They don't. All of these general issues emerge from the details. There's no other way to figure this out. So when we read things about philosophical debates, and especially, I think, debates in philosophical theology, particularly before the 14th and 15th century, and people make general statements about what these debates are about, I'm really skeptical. Because unless you do it, again, from the inside out, I don't think we know what they're talking about. And so, I guess, well, we should end, but maybe we can talk a little bit about who you think is right and why any of us should care about this, which is the last part of this. So, look, all I've tried to do is give you a taste of what it would be like to, I didn't actually do it in the right way, so we participated, but what it would be like to overhear a one-act, right? A one-act play in which someone is trying to share with you a little bit about how Buddhists and non-Buddhist philosophers in the final phase of Buddhism in India debated an issue of Ishvara. It seems to be, if you're interested in Ishvara, it seems terribly uninteresting, right? In some ways, because you don't really get much about Ishvara in these at this part. But it's about something much more fundamental. The way in which Buddhists and Nyayikas argued about Ishvara is the way they argued about everything of philosophical and theological significance for them. And getting a handle on some of these technical details are the best way to get really far, really fast. So this is simply a plea to try to do things from the inside out and give yourself the time and be patient with it. Because if you do, you'll learn things you just can't learn any other way. And you also learn things that you won't forget. And that gives you a perspective on everything that you'll do that I think is invaluable and I think is unique. It's something that we just don't do enough of because it takes too long and it seems really tedious. So I would say start from the inside out, look in all the wrong places, do it early in the morning when you're awake, and do it a little bit every day. And I think real insights will emerge. So that's where we are. Thanks.